Hi, this is Chris Thomas, and you're listening to Talk More Talk.
The whole, you know, origin of where we're all coming from. I'm prepared for death because I don't believe in it. I think it's just getting out of one car and getting into another.
Talk More Talk, the podcast where we celebrate the work of the solo Beatles. And I'm joined tonight by my three co-hosts, Kid O'Toole, Tom Humyadi, and of course, Ken Michaels. Welcome, everybody.
Hi, Ken. Hi, hey. Everyone.
Hey, everybody.
And how you doing?
Tonight, our special topic is the 40th anniversary of the George Harrison album, originally released in February 1979. But up first, Ken Michaels with the news.
Oh, okay. We need to get some dramatic.
Hold on. But up first, Ken Michaels with the news.
All right. We will start with late breaking news. Broke today, March the 18th, about Danny Harrison. And I'm actually quite thrilled for him because he has been chosen to be the opening act for Jeff Lynne's ELO tour for his North American dates this summer. So we're all excited about that. Good news for Danny.
For sure.
Also, yeah, we'll talk about the John and Yoko documentary, Above Us Only Sky, at the end of the newscast here. It'll be the last item. Paul McCartney gets ready to kick off his South American tour with 5 dates running from this Wednesday through the 30th. Starting in Santiago, Chile. He's got the 1 date in Chile, then 1 in Argentina, and 3 dates in Brazil. And if I know how Tom Hunyadi's mind works.
And you don't.
We're all wondering, as Tom is, will he do back in Brazil? In Brazil,
I'm going against. If you're going to say, you know how sportscasters go, you're going to bet for Duke or the field, and I'm going to vote for yes. He's going to do that song.
Okay. You never know with him.
Yes,
you know, he did do a few seconds of Backseat of My Car when he was in Mexico City. I wish he had done the whole song, but nice that he did just that. Paul has also added a second date in Tom's hometown of Las Vegas.
Well, hometown, but
it's becoming that.
Yeah, second hometown.
It's at the T-Mobile Arena. He's already had a show there booked for June 29th. The new show will be June 28th. The pre-sale went on sale. The tickets went on sale for that last week, but they went on sale to the general public today. Also, Ringo starts his all-star band tour this Thursday. That's at Harrah's Resort in Southern California. And exciting news about Ringo, as he posted some photos online of him with Steve Lukather and his co-producer, Bruce Sugar. They have been working on a brand new album for the last few months. So we do know that Ringo is working on a new album, but we don't know when it will be coming out. But it's always exciting to hear. Ringo just keeps on working.
Now, Ken, do you know if there's any change in Ringo's lineup?
Just the one that was announced earlier, that we had Hamish Stewart added to the group. And who else am I forgetting?
Is it the Men at Work guy?
Yeah, Colin Hay. Thank you, Tom.
Oh, so he was there last year. Wasn't the 10cc, and I'm blanking on his name right now, the 10cc guy, I think, is not in this tour, right?
He's out, and also Todd Rundgren is out, And Richard Page from Mr. Mister is out.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, back on the road again.
Again.
With with Ringo. That wasn't planned, folks. More news here. This is something I found out through Tom. Video Music is reporting that a new documentary called An Accidental Studio is being made, which tells the story of George Harrison's groundbreaking film studio, Handmade Films. This will be the first original documentary from AMC UK, and it will air on their channel on May the 4th and on AMC channels internationally later this year. It includes never-before-seen interviews with key players, actors that were in the films, and it's set to capture an extraordinary moment in film history through the eyes of the filmmakers and the actors that were involved, and there's even archival interviews with George Harrison himself in there. Handmade Films created some of Britain's most iconic films, films that every other film company rejected, like The Long Good Friday, Time
Excellent
Bandit.
Film.
And With Nail and I did see Time Bandits in the theater when it came out. I haven't seen most of the Handmade Films, though.
There's some good gems in there. Sorry, there's some really good gems in there. Like Mona Lisa with Bob Hopkins is a great song, great film. And yeah, Time Bandits is probably my favorite kid movie of all time. So a lot of great memories watching that movie. Yeah, love it.
Okay. Yeah, we'll have to do a show on that. On Handmade Films. I'm sure most people know that Handmade Films started when George helped out Monty Python in financing The Life of Brian.
Yes,
and how's this for a segue, folks? It just so happens The Life of Brian is celebrating its 40th anniversary, and it's going to be shown in theaters across the country for a limited run.
Nice.
So, classic. Classic film there from Python guys. Also, we mentioned Danny Harrison, and I'm sure you guys want to chime in on this. There's a new HBO documentary series called The Case Against Adnan Syed, and the music score comes from Danny and Paul Hicks, the two guys from the new Number Two. Now, Danny's been involved a lot with film scores, like Beautiful Creatures, for example.
Right.
This is his latest. And I haven't seen this documentary, but Ken, you're kind of excited about it.
I am. I've seen the first two episodes. It is excellent. It is easily one of the most compelling legal cases of the last, rather murder cases. I don't know if it's necessarily legally interesting, of the last few decades. Of course, it was part of the very popular, the most popular podcast of all time with 175 million plus download serials. So, we're going to dispense with talking about the Beatles tonight to do an entire, the solo Beatles, to do an entire episode in which we analyze whether or not Adnan was in fact guilty from our perspective. So
go ahead.
Well, here on this solo Beatles show, we can all say that he's not guilty.
That is another great transition.
Yes, it is. Oh, very nice. Oh, and by the way, Bruce Bernstein, an alert to viewer here. Remember, Graham Goldman was the name of the TCC. So thank you, Bruce. I was having a brain fart there. So that's what that's the name. All right. So anyway, so sorry to wreck the transition, but I had to throw that in.
That's okay. Some news about Julian. He actually posted this online. He met with music mixer extraordinaire. That's how he describes him. Michael Brower. And Julian says that Michael has mixed some of his favorite albums and tracks, and it looks like they'll be working together on some new music that Julian will bring to the table later this year.
Nice.
It's hard to believe, but Julian's last album, Everything Changes, which was superb, that came out in 2011 already.
Wow.
Hard to believe. But it would be nice to hear some new music from Julian.
It sure would. And it would be lovely to see him have another great act.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, his music for the most part has been really outstanding. And it's just a shame that you know, he broke big in the beginning with a lot, and then the radio airplay kind of diminished after that, even though he put out really strong albums. Should really give his music a chance. Last week, we lost a big giant in the music world, and that's drummer Hal Blaine. Hal Blaine played on countless hits from the 60s, 70s, and up. It is absolutely impossible for anyone to not have heard Hal Blaine being played on the radio, because some of the biggest hits of all time have been from him. Just to mention a few, the Ronettes' Be My Baby, Simon and Garfunkel's Mrs. Robinson, and Bridge Over Troubled Water. So many of the Monkees records, A Taste of Honey from Herb Albert and the Tijuana Brass, The Fifth Dimensions, Aquarius Let the Sunshine In, The Carpenters' Close to You, and one of my favorite of all drumming on record, The Beach Boys' Good Vibrations. Really interesting drumming he does on there.
I'm with you 100%, Ken. That's one of my favorite, absolute favorite drumming performances Hal ever did.
Right. And as far as the Beatles are concerned, because Hal's worked with just about everybody, he is one of the drummers on John's rock and roll album. I know Jim Keltner also played on it. He did say in a video interview that's online that he worked on what he called Ringo's vocal album, which to me means Sentimental Journey, because Ringo didn't drum on it. So, but he didn't know which songs he was on. So I take it to mean he was on Sentimental Journey. With George Harrison, he played on Jackie Lomax's Is This What You Want album, because there were a lot of Wrecking Crew players on that, including Joe Osborne, who we mentioned a few shows ago, because he just passed away as well, the bass player, tremendous bass player there. And he did say also that he's on recordings with Paul McCartney where his drums are overdubbed, but he couldn't name them. And I haven't seen his name connected with Paul's music in any way, but I suppose it's possible. So, but he was an absolutely amazing drummer. You know, it's like he influenced every drummer, whether they know it or not, because his drumming is just embedded in our brains, you know, without you realizing it or not. So any of you want to comment on Hal Blaine?
Oh, just heard from our friend Tom Green, who has and I know Tom. Hi, Tom. That he talked to Hal Blaine and said he was a great guy. He said it was Sentimental Journey.
Okay, well, that's what I was thinking. But what songs from Sentimental Journey?
Oh, yeah. That I don't know. Yeah.
Because there's never been a musician's credit for the songs on Sentimental Journey that I've seen. Mm-hmm. Every song has a different arranger, and we know that it was produced by George Martin, but we haven't seen the musicians listed on Sentimental Journey.
Yeah.
All right. So why don't we talk just briefly before we get to our main topic on the George Harrison album, and that's on the documentary that premiered last Monday on A&E called John and Yoko, Above Us Only Sky, which previously had aired in England on Channel 4. It's about the making of John's Imagine album, and also about the relationship of John and Yoko, and what an influence as well Yoko was on John. So who wants to start first? Tom?
Yeah, sure. You know, it was a little past my bedtime when it aired last week, so I caught it later on. But anyways, very moving, very well done. You know, I can watch George play Oh My Love over and over again. I just love the footage of him playing that song, and I love how, you know, John's talking to George about that song at the beginning during the credits. It was really cool to see Julian there. What, were you gonna say something?
Yeah, well, actually at the very beginning they're rehearsing How.
Yeah. That's right. Was it How or Oh My Love? Or How. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, right. But anyways, but it was really cool to see Julian there, you know, being interviewed, you know, talking about, you know, growing up there and, you know, having fun during the summertime there with the friends, and how it was like, what, 99 acres and just, you know, you know, and it was something I could relate to too, is, you know, it's like he, you know, they got along when they didn't talk about the heavy stuff, meaning him and John, probably, I would assume. So I thought that was kind of cool. And, you know, the way he talked about the song Imagine, how he says it's not religious, not political, it's humanity, life. And I thought that was really cool. I love Yoko's comments on Imagine, where she says, you know, Yoko and her were met were meant to do this song. I thought that was that was pretty powerful. You know, you hear an early version of New York City, which was I thought pretty cool,
right,
with different lyrics. You know, so that was, and then I love how Kiltner is telling a story about how he's there, and I think it's I want to say, oh man, my notes are all over the place. It was Klaus Voormann when he was playing bass, and I can't remember if it was it was Jealous Guy, how Klaus was describing it. You know, him playing the bass, and he described it as he was in a trance state of mind, right, and he just really didn't realize what he was playing. He was just playing. So, but I think I was watching Me and Mr. Mayo. If you're there, hello, Me and Mr. Mayo. How he did his little thoughts on the show, and I thought, you know, he may have been kind of accurate where he's saying, you know, you get all, how many times can you tell a story? You know, I mean, yeah, you've got all this new footage to, and you want to get out there, but you know, it's the same story that we've heard time and time on. And it's just, you know, how many times can you tell the same story, you know? So, but I thought I was still well done, and I look forward. And when it comes down to a home theater release, I'm definitely going to pick it up. Well done.
Okay. Ken, how about you?
I enjoyed it. I mean, Tom makes a very good point there at the end about the search for new content, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, at this point, it is mostly not the music. We're very familiar with it. You know, unlike years past, imagine if this had come out, imagine, that's a pun. I'm following in Ken's footsteps.
Yep.
But imagine if this had come out in 1978, we would have been blown away because we didn't have access to some of the songs, the footage, and even remotely the same way we do now. So I do, when I see documentaries like this, it makes me look forward in a way to the kind of innovative format changes, storytelling opportunities that exist in the future. And I look forward to us experiencing those. But I was really moved by the beginning, as you said, with Hal, where George and John are working together. You know, I could watch that all day. When I watch that, it's as though a clock is ticking, right? And it's that clock we don't think about in life too often, or we would quit paying our bills. But I mean, I would quit paying my bills if I thought about that clock. But it's a tragic clock, right? It's a doomsday clock that John has. There's an expiration date there for them both. And so, as you said, that kind of footage becomes very, very moving.
No, can't argue that point there. Kit, how about you?
You know, I have to say, I was going into this a little skeptically because of all the things that we just said. What else is there to say that's new? We had the wonderful book. We had the, we had Give Me Some Truth. We've had, you know, all these things. And it's like, what else is there to say? And I was pleasantly surprised. Yes, there wasn't a ton of dramatic, you know, dramatically new footage. There were some alternate angles, the extended version of, you know, when that hippie comes to their door and John, you know, treats them, you know, very kindly. And so there's an extended version of that. And so, you know, that was great to see. But what I really liked was how it set the scene of where they were artistically at the time that they made that. And even after, you know, even like right before it came, you know, Imagine came out, where they were. And also just how influential Yoko was. I mean, to me, if there is any doubt left that she didn't have, you know, a major influence on not only his life, but his art, watch this. You know, I just thought that it was, you know, it's one of the most powerful arguments I've seen in one of these documentaries. I mean, you know, and again, it's not things that we've heard before, how she was definitely, you know, her poetry and all was the inspiration for Imagine. We've heard these things. But to have it presented in such a way, and to have the other, you know, some of the musicians who played on the album out totally back it up and say, she was a big part of this album.
You know, Kit, I have to ask then. So you just displayed and made that argument very, very good. But do you feel when you think about it in that way that it's constructed so that you come away with the impression you just stated? I mean, we cannot deny that we're on the heels of her making an argument and succeeding with co-authorship. You know, how do we read that?
Yeah, you know, that is something I've thought about. You know, was it, could you argue that it was, you know, constructed to present, quotes, her side and, you know, to make us believe that. And, you know, and I mean, I have thought about that, but I honestly think they did enough interviews, particularly Klaus Voormann had some great things to say. I thought his insights in this documentary, and he too talked about, you know, how he and Yoko, John and Yoko, just completed each other. And I have a comment here from our friend Mean Mr. Mayo saying that he loved the documentary. First time he had heard the story of how sad John was, you know, in 66, 67. I agree. That's one of the parts that stuck out for me as well. So, you know, yes, you could say, well, it's definitely a pro-Yoko documentary, but I think there's enough evidence there and you know, explanations of her art and so forth to back it up.
I liked how they did go in a little bit in her background.
Yeah.
You know, with her, you know, with her life, you know, a little bit of her, you know, of her childhood and early in her art career. I thought that was great. I thought, you know, anytime we can take a second and to not paint her as the monster that people had described her, you know, late in that Beatles career, early 70s, you know, I say more of it, please. You know, because she's not, well, she wasn't a monster.
And I'll just to continue to play with that for a second. I mean, I've never subscribed to her as being a monster. No. I do not believe at all that she broke up the band.
I agree.
I do think she's a compelling artist. I've been to three of her exhibitions. I love her work in that fashion. I'm a fan of actually a few of her solo albums. Having said that, you know, the scholar in me cannot help but note that she bankrolled this project.
Right.
And, you know, you have to look at the superstructure behind anything, and that exists. So, you know, that doesn't mean that it's not necessarily true or untrue, but it is a fact of the making of it. You know, that's important.
But at the same time, you've got the testimony of all these musicians that will adhere to this, how important Yoko was to John. And you've got John in his lifetime saying the same thing. I mean, what more proof do you need? I don't think enough has been explored about how big an influence Yoko really was on John. I think that there has never been anyone in John's life that was as big an influence as Yoko. Yoko opened up the doors to exploring everything there is out there and looking at it as art. And I think that John felt restricted being in the Beatles, as crazy as that sounds. You know, I do think that he felt stifled being in the Beatles because there are limitations when you're in a band and you're working with the same musicians over and over again, as great as they are. But with Yoko, anything was possible. If you wanted to make an album where you've got 2 minutes of silence on there, that's art. If you want to make an album where you're just saying each other's names, John Yoko, over and over again, that's art. Some people look at it as art. Some people think of it as garbage. You know, it's all subjective, no matter how you look at it. There are people out there, I think it was John Cage, who staged the concert where he had a 38-minute piece and it was all silence.
Yes,
and people sat in the audience and observe this. Is that art? You know, I think that John loved the fact that, you know, you had endless possibilities working with Yoko. He could do anything that he wanted to, and he still maintained putting out his pop albums in the process, and yet he found her fascinating. He found the avant-garde world fascinating. She taught him a lot about it, some things he didn't understand, and that made him even more fascinated in her. So, you know, not to take away anything away from the other Beatles, but Yoko was definitely the biggest influence overall in John's life and the artist that he became. And I think that this brings it out in the film. Especially there's this one scene where Yoko's talking in the studio during the Imagine sessions, making a suggestion about the lyrics of one of the songs there, kind of whispering it to John. So we have no idea how much more of that there was, but we do know from the people who were there, who played on the album, what they saw. And I certainly, you know, Klaus Voormann is very believable to me. How many people on this planet have the history of the Beatles as much as Klaus Voormann, other than the Beatles themselves?
You know, and Klaus has a very good BS detector, if you will. He, you know, we've all met him at the Fest for Beatles fans, and he is, frankly, among all of the constituents in the documentary and elsewhere, he really, you know, he speaks very plainly and very truthfully. So we have to give him a lot of credit. You know, the thing that Yoko gave him, and I think you were sort of dancing around it there, Tom, and so sorry, Ken, is the idea of risk. You know, by the time the Beatles get to 1969, they're not taking a lot of risk. They are virtuosic in the way they're delivering their sound. And, you know, obviously Abbey Road is an incredible high note and fantastic work of art. But I don't know if anybody would call it a risk, right? And what Yoko does give him, and it was the cornerstone of her art long before she met him, was the idea of just taking risks. And that means you're open to failure, right? And John does have failures. He does have songs post-Beatles that don't work, and works of art that maybe we don't feel at times that they necessarily maybe meet the strictures of what we feel like have the greatest artistic merit. But that doesn't matter because he's taking the risk, right? And the risk of great artists is failing, you know, because then the success is all the more sweeter and all the more powerful when it does occur.
You know, in a way, I feel like we may never have had an album like Plastic Ono Band if Yoko Ono wasn't in John Lennon's life. Same thing as Cold Turkey as a song. Sure. I mean, the Beatles rejected Cold Turkey. You know, they also rejected What's the New Mary Jane, whether or not you feel that was a wise decision or not. But, you know, John was definitely, he liked the idea of, you know, anything was up for grabs. He could do whatever he felt like with Yoko. And, you know, I think that this documentary touches on that. And you can definitely go deeper on that subject.
For sure.
We should have a Yoko only, which actually was a phrase once, right? Yoko only. We should have a Yoko only episode or series of episodes at some point.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be interesting.
Because, you know, she is a polarizing and highly complex figure.
And I should add, there's a great book that really changed my view of Yoko's art. And it's called The Beatles and the Avant-Garde. And it's written by someone that I think we all know here, Aaron Kanovich. And I really enjoyed that book because he goes through not just Yoko, but the avant-garde movement in the late 60s in general and how it influenced the Beatles and their music. And of course, he goes into Yoko's art and he does a really nice job of, you know, really explaining what the meaning was behind this movement so that, you know, those who don't may not like her art can say, well, it's not for me, but I see what I see what her point was. I see what the point of that movement was, you know, to question art itself.
Right.
So, yeah, I highly recommend that. I really, that book opened my eyes to that whole, the Fluxus movement and all of that.
Well said.
If I can add real quick, the last thing I'll mention about the thing is I was really moved, or I thought it was really powerful how she talked about one of her first things that she thought about as a 4-year-old was two seeds, you know, coming together and then being planted and whether or not it was like a pine tree and an apple tree, you know, joining, you know, together. And I thought that was pretty brilliant thing to say. And, you know, I love learning more about her. I would love to learn more about her. So, yeah. I would love to do a Yoko show.
Yep.
It shows what kind of an imaginative mind she had even then.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Our friend Rob agrees, said Yoko only series of episodes. I agree. So, all right. I think we're going to have to do that in the future.
All right.
Yeah. One more thing. I think it was you, Tom, that brought it up. The performance of John doing New York City. That was from a film called Clock, which was recorded at the St. Regis Hotel in New York City. The audio from that has been bootlegged for a long time, and it was at one time played on the Lost Lennon tapes. And John does a lot of 50s rock, mainly Buddy Holly, a little Carl Perkins on there. I kind of wish we had more of that.
Yeah.
Because we only had New York City in there. I'd love to see the whole thing.
No kidding.
So, that was such a moment, too, because it had you rethink that a little bit, you know, and I enjoyed that.
Me too.
It put a different slant on something that you know, it was easy to criticize, and it was powerful.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we should probably turn it over now to the George Harrison album.
Yes, I think so.
Before we exhaust, oh, well done. Look at this.
Oh, and since this is such a tropical album, I have to put on something that, that I wear when I'm in Turks and Caicos, which is my, my trusty sun hat. And, you know, because when I listen to this album, that's what I think of. Sun, yeah.
As the queen of all media, are you currently drinking a pina colada or a Mai Tai or?
I don't know what you're talking about. This is a Coke.
Ah, product placement. It's finally happened. Yes. We have our first sponsor. Well done.
Yeah, there you go.
And we should have also another special episode where Tom explains the system that he uses at the Vegas crap tables. we don't gather all that well. Okay. It's that's right. Why don't we begin with a discussion about the kind of return to form that happens with George Harrison. It's an album that really all of us, frankly, are contemporaries of, right? I mean, it's we should have distinct memories of this record coming out. I know I do. It was a big moment for me. It was such an instant recognizable moment when I heard the song Blow Away. Mm-hmm. Roiling over the radio, you know, and it was obviously it has so many trademarks, right, of George Harrison's, even down to the lyrical discussion of the weather, but also just that beautiful, sunny guitar sound, right, that we know so well with the slide and just the beautiful feeling of it all. And it does have to validate Kit's ensemble. It does have a, there you go. It does have a very tropical, breezy feel, really. So do you recall when you first heard it, Ken?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's one of the few songs that actually triggers a specific memory for me, because when that song came out, it was around the springtime, and I used to go to college, and I drove to my local college on Long Island, and I would have the radio on, and I would always hear it on the way to college when the sun came out early in the morning. Uh-huh. And I just associated with that. I always associate the song with springtime, and it's just a happy go lucky song there, you know, all I got to do is to love you. And, you know, but I always associate it with that on my way to college. But and of course, you know, you have the rain and the sun there in the song, but I always associate it with the springtime and sunny times and happy times.
Kid,
you know, I have to admit, I do not have a memory of when this originally came out. I was 8 years old, so I didn't really, I wasn't into the Beatles yet, but I do remember the first time I heard Blow Away, years later, probably in, I don't know, maybe in high school, and I just was so taken with it, and I still am. It's to me one of the, it's almost a perfect pop rock kind of single. I mean, you know, it's just, it just instantly takes you to another place, you know, it really does. And just beautiful. So I remember that, thoroughly, but I actually don't remember. In fact, it was, you know, when you go on YouTube, you can see videos, of course, for Blow Away and Faster. And, I had never seen those. And so,
what?
Yeah, I've seen them since, but I mean, when they first came out. Oh yes, I've seen them before, but no, particularly Blow Away. That's pretty memorable. But
we may have to divest you of the hat. I'm sorry, Kit.
I've made my point. Yeah. So, but anyway, so yeah. So it. So I don't remember it when it was on, but when it first came out. But I absolutely love this album, and I'm really thrilled to.
I'm with Mean Mr. Mayo. It was an album that for me, it was one that, you know, I purposely went to the store to buy. While I wasn't eight, I wasn't that far off, and I had to count my dollars and pennies to go make that purchase, and it was an important one for me. What about you, Tom?
Well, being the youngster in the group here, I was six when that album came out. So it wasn't until a decade later. I remember, if you remember, on watching VH1, they used to have sometimes weekends dedicated to certain artists. And I remember when, you know, Cloud Nine was big, and then we also got, you know, the best of Dark Horse and Traveling Wilburys. So it was a great time to be a George fan. And then you would have a weekends dedicated to a particular artist, and they would have a weekend dedicated to George Harrison, where they would just show all of his videos. And that was the first time I got to see Blow Away, which is, you know, the video and listen to the song, which I respond very well to, you know, the positivity.
Tom,
I mean,
were you blown away?
I was very blown away. I thought it's a great song. It's like you guys said, I mean, it's a great pop song. It's excellent. It's positive. I think people respond well to positivity and a clear outlook, if you will. And I guess we just got to thank Friar Park for having a leak in the roof for this song to come about. Yeah. Because, yeah, you know, but yeah. And then this video is very silly, in my opinion. A lot of weird close-ups, which, you know, go well with the album cover, you know. So, but yeah, great song.
So you were born in 1973?
Correct.
So
the greatest
you were born
year in solo.
You got
solo
that
history.
Right. You got that right, buddy. Yeah. Nothing will ever top 1973 for me.
Correct.
Well, and frankly, 73, you know, beside the ex Beatles, was a marvelous year. I mean, the music of the early 70s, it's absolutely stunning. Mm-hmm. You know, the high quality. And speaking of which, you know, if you do any kind of rudimentary background research into the George Harrison album, you can see that it reached number 16. And you might think that's kind of a, maybe not a high rung for such a quality record and such a huge artist. But that, you know, going back to what I just said about 1973, we have to recall that 1979 was very competitive too.
Yeah.
There was lots of different music coming together. Storming the charts. A lot of evergreen artists were around, not to mention plenty of new groups, new waves, literally.
Right.
And disco, certainly. And it was highly competitive during that period. And, you know, for George to perform that well isn't a slight on him at all. That's pretty good stuff. Back in those days, of course, units weren't equivalent streams, right? Those were actually units sold in the store. Some people have written that it's a kind of return to form. Do you see it that way, Kit, with this album?
You know, I guess I've always felt like this album and 33 and a third could be almost bookends in a yep. way, because to me, those two are his sort of creative resurgence. And it's interesting, you know, I read a review or an interview of George from 1979 of Rolling Stone, you know, right when the album came out. And he said that. He said a number of people had said to him, "This is your best since All Things Must Pass." I think it's one of them. I don't know if it's the absolute best since All Things Must Pass, because that's kind of hard to say. But mm-hmm. I just feel like it is such a strong piece of work. You know, remember, he was coming out of a pretty difficult period when, you know, he was working on, well, basically, you know, both albums. But he had found this new contentment after, I mean, you know, we don't have to go through all the different, different things that he went through with his
well I think we should out. We should yeah but we should note that, you know, in 1976 he was very ill. Not to mention having some financial constraints. He's working with a record label in the post Apple period. There's a lot going on in his life, and mm-hmm. you can hear that, as I think you're suggesting, that sound of contentment,
right?
Mm-hmm. That's coming through. What about you, Tom?
I hate to get into that, you know, this is his best album since, but I still find myself doing it. This is a top three album for me. It's a great, you know, guitar work album for me. It's a very happy album for me. Very optimistic, very positive album. And let's face it, you know, I don't see this trouble that, or this, I see him in a really great mood. I see him doing things that he wants to do. He spent a whole year doing the Formula One, you know, Formula One thing. And we all know when he gets into something, he's really into it, especially like the sitar and, you know, and other things that in his past, that when he's really into it, he spends the time, you know, learning about it and doing it. You know, he's creating handmade films. He's in the Ruddles, the Ruddles movie. He's, you know, getting ready to have a child and getting married. So I see a lot of happiness, you know, and out of that comes this wonderful album. And is it a good return to form? Maybe, but what is the form? I mean, if we were comparing it to All Things Must Pass, then, you know, maybe, you know, but, you know, there's, I've always find things to like in all of his albums. And, I, you know, and to this one, I think from top to bottom, it might be one of the strongest, in my opinion, since All Things Must Pass, maybe. So, yeah, I mean, it is. I think it's a classic George Harrison album from top to bottom.
Yep. How about you, Ken?
I think it's definitely one of his strongest. I wouldn't say it's a return to form, kind of like what Tom and Kit were saying, because 33 and a Third was a great album. You know, don't dismiss 33 and a Third at all, but when you have those two albums back to back, it's hard to find two albums, consecutive albums, that are as strong, although Living in the Material World is my all-time favorite George Harrison album. So when you follow All Things Must Pass with that, it's kind of hard to top that. But, you know, every song on the George Harrison album I've always loved. When it first came out, I liked it a lot. I think over time, it sounds better and better. I think the songs are stronger. The melodies are very strong. His guitar playing is wonderful. His guitar playing is always wonderful. But when you're listening to the slide of something like Your Love Is Forever, it's simple and perfect. Mm-hmm. And it sets a mood. You get the feeling, and he did write a lot of this material in Hawaii, but it feels like he wrote it in Hawaii. And it feels like he's in Hawaii, and you're listening to him. And you've got palm trees around you, and you're laying on the beach. It's got that very soft, laid-back feel to it. And I love it for that reason. I love all the messages. There was one other thing I wanted to bring up, and that is that a lot of people love that period of 33 and a Third and George Harrison because it shows a lighter side of George. It's not the very religious, very preachy, gloomy George Harrison that some people probably interpreted with Living in the Material World, for example.
Yes.
And often, it's more, I mean, when you're talking about 33 and a Third, I immediately think of Cracker Box Palace and George in the video popping out of the baby pram, you know, and making fun of the lawsuit of My Sweet Lord. And this song, it's showing the comical side, the lighter side of George. And a lot of people take to that, which is why I think Cloud Nine worked so much. You know, it wasn't a very, very spiritual, serious album. And, you know, the songs on the George Harrison album are about love. If you believe, a positive message to the world, believing in yourself, you know, it's nothing really depressing or preachy or anything like that. And I think a lot of people connect with that side of George. Believe me, there's many sides to George Harrison, which make him fascinating. But when you're looking at those two albums, it's really hard for me, like Kit, not to connect those two albums.
Yes.
They're very similar in a lot of ways for that reason.
Now, you Kit, I'm sorry, I have to stop everybody. Kit, what's going on?
What's going on?
Why is the hat off?
Oh! Well, you know, all good tropical feelings have to, you know, have to come to an end at some point. You know, you have too much fun.
Okay, so, fine. You know, I mean, I'm not going to pressure you. It just, I thought it was becoming part of your legend. So, moving on, Mr. Mayo has made a very good suggestion, and that is we should consider, you know, the inclusion of a song that I think meant a lot to us because we recognized it from the Beatle years, even though we didn't have maybe too much familiarity with it back in 1979, and that is Not Guilty. Mm-hmm. I think it would be interesting to hear everyone's impressions on that. It invites comparisons. And I know that so many people like myself, when the anthology came out in the mid-1990s, and we suddenly had our hands on a mastered version of the White Album outtake that we were immediately comparing them. I was playing them side by side, and I'll admit to that. So any memories or at least thoughts on that issue of not guilty versus not guilty? Patless, would you start first?
That's going to be my new nickname now. Now I know it.
Yeah, now, the queen is dead.
The queen is dead. I'm glad that Mr. Mayo brought this up because, I was thinking the same thing that I have to say. I mean, I love this album, but I prefer the original version. This is extremely well played, by the way. I mean, the keyboards and the bass on this cut, I mean, on the,
Willie
on the
Weeks.
George Harrison version are incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, really incredible. But it does, that arrangement does take away from kind of the nastiness, you know, in a way. And I mean, it wasn't completely vicious, but, you know, just sort of the sneering kind of part of the song and that very soft kind of arrangement to me detracts from that. So, I mean, when you hear the White Album, you know, demo and then some of the early versions, I like that one better. I think the early version captures the meaning of those lyrics a lot more. So I hesitate to say, it's not that I don't like this version, but I just think the arrangement takes away from the original intention.
So Hatless, are you saying then that it maybe it mutes the original in a way?
In a way, yeah. I mean, I think it does. As I said, it just sort of and I hate to say waters down because again, I'm not trying to. You know, I love the song. Don't get
like
me
a
wrong.
Rainstorm. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it just to me it just, you know, yeah, mutes the original intention of the song. I just think it's just the arrangement. It just doesn't really match the lyrics for me.
What about you, Ken? When you were driving down those Long Island highways and byways on your way to college, what about this not guilty versus not guilty? Who's guilty?
Well, I have to say that I don't agree with Kit. My favorite version is the one that's on the solo album. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is because I think it was more fully developed. I love the Beatles version because it's grittier, it rocks, it's electric guitars as opposed to an acoustic treatment. It's more laid back on the George Harrison album, but I feel that the Beatles never really finished Not Guilty in the studio. There's a moment there where there could have been a guitar solo and there isn't. It's kind of like, well, what do we do here? And it's left hanging like that. But the thing about the Beatles version, which kind of annoys me, is that you keep hearing that riff over and over and over again. Da-da-da-da-da. You want the whole song. And at least it's a little bit held back on George Harrison's solo version. It really works as a soft song. And there's that one part where he doesn't have words, but he's going do 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 do, you know. But it works. It's a something into the song. It sounds more complete on the solo version, you know. I understood. You know, good.
That's a thoughtful remark because you know you made me with your comment just now really think about maybe what is holding back that White Album version. It does stick out like a sore thumb in the sense that it is repetitive, right? And one of the great gems of the Beatles' career is just incredible variety, even in the same song, right? What a staggering thing to think about. Very, very well said. Tom. Now, Tom, you either have to talk about Not Guilty or, of course, Casino advice.
Casino advice. the best casino movie of all time, starring Robert De Niro, Casino. But anyways,
I think Tom might be.
Wait a minute.
Can you hear anything?
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
I can hear
Tom.
Can you hear me?
Oh, okay. I'm not hearing him. So go ahead. All sorry, right. Tom.
Yes. That's ignore all right. Hatless.
Ignore Hatless.
Yes. I tend to agree with Kit. I prefer the Beatles anthology or the White Album, you know, demo that we got. I agree. The arrangement I think is a little too soft for me. I think lyrically it doesn't necessarily fit the George Harrison album. I think, I mean, music, arrangement, it fits that album, but you know, you hear so much positivity, happiness in the George Harrison album that this kind of, in a way, maybe takes away from that a little bit. And plus it's not as powerful because it's so far removed from the events that the song is about. But I still enjoy it nonetheless. I think it's an enjoyable song, but I tend to like that, you know, the harder da-na-na-na-na, and I think I enjoy the hops chord. But I will tell you, the Willie Weeks, you know, bass on this song and throughout the whole album is amazing. I just want to give him the props that he deserves.
Nice. So, you know, in our time that we have left, I think we should talk about high points or low points if you've got them, but certainly high points of the record, Queen Hatless.
Oh my gosh. I mean, there are so many incredible moments on here. Love Comes to Everyone, great opener. I just think that's, yeah, it sort of sets the tone for the whole album. You know, that's his message, that it's about this, as we've talked about, this contentment that he's found. Here Comes the Moon, one of his best, beautiful. You know, it just, you know, it's just such an enchanting kind of song. I also, I like Your Love Is Forever, because I think George does some really interesting things with his voice on that song, particularly, you know, in the ones like Split and My Heart Knows That We Share It Together, when he lets us, you know, kind of reaches the higher ranges of his voice. It just, you know, I really think he was stretching himself in a great way in that song. So that's another highlight. And of course, Dark Sweet Lady. Beautiful, kind of his maybe I'm amazed in a way, in terms of tribute to a woman who, you know, saved him and went, you know, helped him through a rough time. I mean, the harp in it too. Oh, yeah. I mean, what, so unexpected in a way. I hadn't listened to that song in a while, and when the harp came in, I was like, oh yeah, I'd forgotten there's sort of this harp in it. But it works. Yeah, it's just you know, there are just so many highlights, but those are the ones that are my personal favorites. Beautiful lyrics, wonderful vocal performance, great arrangements.
Ken.
There's so many highlights here. I do love Love Comes to Everyone as an album opener, and the message in the song that love can come to everyone. We all need to hear songs like that. And there aren't many songs that have meant as much to me from George as If You Believe. If You Believe is a song where, if you read the message in there, we've all had experiences in life where people have upset us or let us down. And if you read the lyrics there, it helps you get through it. And I've read those lyrics many times. Too many troubles you can't control to get you falling into the holes they dig for you. You know, it's really powerful stuff that he wrote with Gary right there. Here Comes the Moon. I mean, you listen to that song, you feel like you're floating on air, like you're in the clouds. And it really does feel that way. And it's really a beautiful song.
You have to get your hat back on, you know.
Maybe you should take your own advice, kid.
Yeah, that's right.
And also, I will say that as someone who loves love songs, you will not get two songs back to back any better than Dark Sweet Lady and Your Love Is Forever. Dark Sweet Lady is an absolute gorgeous song. You talked about the harp in there, the like the Spanish guitar solo in the middle is absolutely gorgeous. The melody in there is exquisite. I love when George does this thing. Every now and then on some of his songs, he has these wide intervals that he sings, like When I Let Go, you know, in Dark Sweet Lady, it's kind of like the wide intervals that he uses in a song like Deep Blue, for example, or For You Blue. Sorry for my singing, folks.
No, I think we could do a special episode of you singing too.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Oh, well.
We need to build our audience here.
Oh, okay. So, fair enough.
But yeah, Blow Away is an outstanding single. It's, you know, it's just classic George. It's as catchy as can be. I know George said that he was embarrassed because he thought the song was just so obvious the way that it went, but it works. And that's all that matters, really, when you get down to it. I love Faster. Great slide guitar work on that song. And it's just, it's cool to think that he wrote a song about Formula One racers. You know, I mean, it was a big part of his life. And, you know, I just love the fact that he dedicated a song there based on the title of a Jackie Stewart book. They're all great. All the songs on here are great. But when the album first came out, I liked it a lot. Now I think it's outstanding. I love the album more now than I ever have before. It's one that has aged really, really well. And I just think over time it gets stronger and stronger every single time you hear it. And I don't mean to neglect the other songs that I didn't mention, like Soft Touch. I love all of them, you know. It's really a powerful album. But then George has made a lot of powerful albums.
All right. Well, thank you. And Tom, not to be outdone.
Yes. You know, like I said earlier, it's from top to bottom, it's a very strong album. I'll get to my low point out of the way really quick. Love Comes to Everyone, great slide guitar throughout that whole track, but that Eric Clapton solo I think was maybe not needed, not necessary. However, he did do a great cover on his Back Home album of that song. So, but anyways, yeah, Blow Away, beautiful song, Faster. George needed to rock more throughout his career. I don't think he rocked as much in his career that I would have. I mean, you think of Devil's Radio and Faster. It would have been cool to have an album of all just, you know, straight rockers from George. I've never been a great fan of Your Love Is Forever until this last week when I started re-listening to this album. What a beautiful song. What great guitar work, and his vocals are superb on that song. Beautiful, beautiful song. Like I said, If You Believe, great message. You know, I wish he did more stuff with Gary Wright. I know those two are pretty close. Here Comes the Moon. Why it's on Best of Dark Horse instead of Faster, I'll never figure that out. But it was kind of confusing when I picked up Best of Dark Horse and that song was on there, and you think, oh, this must have been a single back in the day, and then you find out that it wasn't. But anyways, and I'll never forgive that CD for not having this song on it either. Great stuff. Great lyrically. He must have been in a really happy place, like I was, you know, discovering doing the research on this album, because the lyrics are so positive, you know, minus Not Guilty. But anyways, it's just a great album. And but go ahead, Ken.
Oh, well said, Tom. And if you noticed, one of our colleagues noted a moment ago that he had just purchased, as we all would have or had, Love in Town. There is a kind of good vibe in their work at this point. You know, I do see those albums as having maybe not a direct relationship, but in terms, there is a certain vibe that exists. Maybe it's just the late 70s, and I wish I was that kid on a bike again, right? Who knows? Because nostalgia does play into this, as we heard Tom say earlier when he was driving to college. But I'm being very serious here. I mean, there is a certain positive sense. I'm saying positive now. Thank you, Tom. There is that kind of, throwback nostalgia we have for those moments. And they do really exist. So well said.
One more thing with Soft Hearted Hannah too. I love the fact that he admits that he was on a mushroom, bender when he wrote this song. You know, the first, you know, I ate it, and once my eyes could see, no sooner had I ooped it down, I felt so far off the ground I stood on. I think that's brilliant. So, nice. But go ahead, Ken.
Do you like what they did at the end of that song, where they adjusted the speed of the song?
Oh yes, I meant to say that too. How they was on like uneven, yeah. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Very exactly. Unique effect, right there.
Like a mushroom high.
Yeah, like a mushroom high.
I mean, that's obviously the point. I'm right. Good at stating the obvious.
Yeah. And you know, when George put out Gone Tropo, I mean, I had some of the same feelings. You think tropical. You know, kind of like the George Harrison album. Right. So there are certain songs where I'm just picturing, as I'm hearing it, being in Hawaii or being on a tropical island. So it's a bit similar.
You know, it is interesting as we close out today's episode, to think about the fact that he did name the album George Harrison, right? I mean, that in itself is quite telling. You know, at some level, he obviously wanted, to borrow Tom's word yet again, this positive album to be associated with his name, right? So I do think that speaks volumes about the place he was at in his life, if not the mushrooms. Certainly a kind of a connection, right? He's naming it. You know, he's hardly an unknown quantity in 1979. Mm-hmm. You know, still one of the most famous people in the world, and great artists, and yet he chooses this album to call George Harrison. So, you know, before we sign off tonight, we should alert our listeners and viewers to the fact that, you know, if you enjoy this show and, you know, you want to be up close and personal with a woman named Hatless, you're actually going to get a chance in just a few. Oh, she's just toying with us. Ah, there it is. Now you're the queen again. If you want to see the queen of all Beatles media in person, live, all you need do is get yourself to Jersey City in, what, fewer than 2 weeks?
Yep. Last weekend of March.
Indeed. Another way of saying it. And you could come see not just the queen, but all of us live. We'd be happy to meet with you, and we'd be doing an episode of our show recorded live, as we did at the White Album Conference. We'll be recording it live in Jersey City, and that's something to look forward to. So we hope to see you in person, if not virtually on the show. What exactly is our date, Queen?
I don't know when exactly the, because the schedule hasn't come out yet. So I don't know if we're going to be Saturday or Sunday of that weekend. But of course, we will alert you all on our Facebook page and Twitter and all those places, so you know. And then we are, as Ken said, we are recording it. I'm not sure if we're going to be airing it live, but it will, I mean, we're working out those details now, but it will be up on our page at some point that week if it doesn't air live. So just subscribe to our page. We will keep you posted on developments, but I think you're really going to like the topic.
Now, Queen, I'm just going to say what's on everybody's mind. Is that hat going to be in Jersey City?
You just have to come to the panel and find out.
I'm going to the panel now. I was like 30-70 against. I'm going now. I'm going.
See? You have to come now.
Well, thank you, dear viewers, for another great episode. We'll see you soon, perhaps live, but we'll see you for sure. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. What?